Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Remember all those promises that the new financial regulations will look out for the little guy? No more fine print mumbo jumbo, the president said, that they'd have to offer plain vanilla investments alongside the fancy stuff. That sound you heard today was Congress and the White House backtracking as fast as they can. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Wednesday, the 23rd of September. Great to have you with us, as always. The House Financial Services Committee had a little get-together today. Chairman Barney Frank hosted the first of a series of hearings into how to reform the regulations governing the financial industry. Today's topic was the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, and it seems that the CFPA, as it's known, is going to do somewhat less actual protecting of consumers than we had been led to believe. Retailers will be exempt. Auto dealers and real estate brokers exempt from its purview as well. No obligation to provide those plain vanilla investment devices. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner said the proposal was useful, but that the White House would like it to be a little bit tougher. So if things are moving in that direction, backpedaling that is, we wondered what the White House might be able to get done on its own. And we put that question to our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
The short answer is not much, according to leading financial reform advocates we spoke to today. The administration is already working around Congress. The Treasury Department and Securities and Exchange Commission have drafted a collection of their own tighter rules. But Harvard University professor Hal Scott argues those are just strings in a tangled safety net. Scott is director of the Independent Committee on Capital Markets Regulation. He says only Congress has the authority to redesign the entire regulatory structure.
I believe that's absolutely essential to translate any of this substance into real, lasting, effective action.
Which is exactly what Treasury Secretary Geithner was pressing for today to unravel the financial mess.
We believe we cannot achieve that within our current framework of diffused authority with responsibility divided among a complex mix of different supervisors and authorities who have different missions and many other priorities.
On some issues, the administration's hands are tied altogether. John Coffey heads Columbia University's Center for Corporate Governance. He says only Congress can crack down on the complicated derivative investments widely blamed for triggering the financial meltdown.
That's because Congress expressly deregulated over-the-counter derivatives, and only Congress can cancel that mistake made back in 2000.
The Treasury Secretary cautioned today the momentum for a financial fix could be lost as the memory of the crisis recedes. But Harvard's Hal Scott warns that lawmakers had better not underestimate their constituents.
We still have unbelievable levels of unemployment, and we're going to have them for some time. People suffered great wealth losses. They're not going to forget about that. People whose homes were foreclosed are not going to forget about that. When we have the next elections, the American people are going to be rightly asking, what has the Congress and administration done about this?
In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The island of Manhattan is not the place to be today if you want to get somewhere in a hurry. The United Nations General Assembly kicked off its session today. That means the streets are packed with long black limousines, and airports in the New York metropolitan area are more crowded than usual. And that only adds to New York's carbon footprint. But in keeping with Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's efforts to make the UN more green, yesterday, the day of the UN's climate change summit, will actually end up being carbon neutral, thanks to a big check being sent to rural India. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson explains.
It's simple addition and subtraction, according to Janos Pastor, the director of the UN Secretary General's climate change support team.
We've counted one head of state with one advisor traveling from different parts of the world, then taking a taxi, coming to Manhattan and back, and some internal traffic within the city. And then based on that, we calculated the footprint.
And then, Pastor says, the UN decided how many credits it needed to buy and send to rural India to build biogas plants that reduce the need to cut down trees for fuel.
This is, in fact, the most reliable type of offsets that we have at present in the global carbon market.
A market that came out of the Kyoto Protocol that allows developed countries to invest in carbon-cutting projects in emerging nations. But would the project in India be going forward without the UN's money? I asked Dan Esty, director of the Yale Center for Environmental Law and Policy.
It depends on the sort of precise nature of the offsets that have been purchased, but a good quality offset is an investment that would otherwise not have taken place.
And Esty says as the carbon credit market grows, it's becoming easier to track offsets and verify their legitimacy.
There's also some folks who are starting to securitize these offsets and to try and make them into kind of financial instruments that can be traded. I think that's less exciting from the point of view of the planet, but perhaps part of the maturing of this marketplace.
Ay, ay, ay. Get ready for the carbon credit bubble and bust. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Dunkin' Donuts store owners have wrapped up their fall get-together in Worcester, Massachusetts this week. There was the usual talk of glazed versus jelly-filled. But franchisees were really buzzing about the latest product being cooked up, lawsuits. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
It's like a food fight, with franchise owners hurling accusations of harassment and Dunkin' Donuts throwing back denials it's doing anything wrong. The company routinely accuses franchisees of legal infractions, like not filling out tax forms or having cracked floor tiles, says franchisee attorney Robert Zarco. He says the company then socks his clients with huge fees and lawsuits, the object to push them out and get new franchisees to buy into the donut chain.
There have been over 350 lawsuits in order to squeeze franchisees out of the system or extracting substantial dollars in financial penalties.
We have never pursued litigation against a franchisee without clear cause, nor will we.
That's Dunkin' Donuts spokesperson Karen Raskoff. She says the company only sues franchisees to safeguard the brand. Jim Cohen heads the Franchise Owners Association. He says it's too bad relations are so testy because Dunkin' Donuts is doing great. Last year, sales were up 5%.
Whereas Starbucks may be positioned as a more expensive brand, Dunkin' Donuts positioned their marketing towards the working class, towards the average Joe.
Attorney Robert Zarco says Dunkin' Donuts should focus on the food.
The coffee's got to taste good and be nice and hot. The donuts have to be fresh.
It's a recipe that would please franchise owners and customers alike. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Wall Street had it going on for a while today, then it lost it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Alongside its interest rate announcement today, rates are going to stay exactly where they are, by the way. The Federal Reserve said something else, that it's going to start easing off one of the big lending programs it put in place when the credit crisis was at its worst. That is what you call a perfect segue to let us pick up on something we started yesterday, a discussion of exactly how to unwind some of those things the government has done in the past year to keep the economy afloat. If you thought banks paying back $700 billion in TARP money was tricky, try figuring out what's going to happen when the Federal Reserve pulls back its trillions of dollars in support. Alice Rivlin is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. She's also a former vice chairman of the Board of Governors at the Federal Reserve. Mrs. Rivlin, welcome to the program.
Good to be here, Kai.
If I could have you remind us, using as few acronyms as possible, some of the ways the Federal Reserve has been bailing out this economy the past year or 18 months or so.
The Federal Reserve has done some truly remarkable things. They first facilitated the rescue of Bear Stearns, the rescue of AIG. They opened the discount window where commercial banks have always been able to borrow to banks that were not commercial banks, investment banks. And they began buying up securities backed by assets like credit cards and mortgages to make sure that credit is flowing to people who want to borrow it to buy a house or to buy a car or to buy something on their credit card. So they entered into the financial markets in a big way.
On the order of trillions of dollars, right?
Absolutely.
Do me a favor and do a little compare and contrast, would you, between the TARP, that bank bailout, and the Federal Reserve's programs and how unwinding those might be different.
The TARP was originally supposed to buy toxic assets from the banks. It never actually did that, but it invested, the Treasury invested directly in the banks, and the wind-down process there will be the banks paying the Treasury back. Some of them already have. The lending programs of the Federal Reserve are actually more complicated, and there are quite a large number of them, and they will wind down as the Federal Reserve sees the private markets taking over.
And what's the mechanism by which the Federal Reserve starts pulling back some of this money? Do they just go to the banks and the dealers in New York and say, okay, we're not going to do as much now?
In effect, yes. Or they just stop doing as much, and they can certainly get back to something normal in a reasonable period, but they won't do it quickly.
Let me ask you this, just as a hypothetical. What happens if tomorrow the Fed just shuts off all its programs?
That's not going to happen because it would be much too worrisome. Yeah. The financial system has become dependent on borrowing from the Federal Reserve in very large amounts, and shutting it off quickly would put us back into a financial crisis. Nobody's going to do that.
We had Tony Sanders from George Mason University on yesterday, and we asked him this question, how long it's going to take to unwind the TARP investments, the big bank bailouts. He said, you know, 3-4 years about that. What's your take on how long it's going to take to unwind some of these Fed investments, given that they've already started?
A lot depends on what happens to the economy and how the financial sector responds. The whole point is to get the financial sector stabilized, which seems to have happened, and get them lending again so that the real economy can recover. And we don't know exactly how long that's going to take or whether there might be some problems still to come. A lot of people are worried about commercial real estate loans. And those may be on the books of a lot of community banks. They may not be worth as much as they thought. There may be some problems still to come.
Alice Rivlin, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Ms. Rivlin, thanks so much for your time.
Delighted to be here.
The going back to school shopping season was kind of lousy for a lot of retailers, but now that college students have arrived back in class, there is hope again. Sales of all those desk lamps, toaster ovens, and throw rugs for otherwise dreary dorm rooms are expected to top more than $600 million this year. And one retailer is even throwing a party to make sure it gets a slice. From WBUR in Boston, Monica Brady-Myrov reports.
It's Friday night outside a Target store near Boston. Employees wear T-shirts that say, Smart Scholars Save Dollars, as they hand out free soda to hundreds of freshmen from Boston College. Target paid for 8 buses to shuttle students between the store and campus. Freshman Kevin Chapin says he already did most of his back-to-school shopping, but came anyway.
More to meet people and get some stuff.
The store was closed to the public, and inside, a DJ set the tone for what felt more like a dorm party than a shopping trip. Target planned the event with Boston College, and it was included in the school's official freshman activities. That's what attracted Erin Conlon.
Fun to hang out with people that you just met and get to know more people, like on the bus, because it seemed like everyone was going, so it seemed like a good idea.
Freshmen are the prime targets because most don't own cars and aren't old enough to drink, so they consider a Friday night at Target a good time. Kathleen Siders, associate professor of marketing at Boston College, calls it a good strategy.
And this is exactly the demographic that Target wants. These are fairly affluent kids, in many cases, at a lot of these private schools.
Most retailers rely on coupons and ad inserts to attract college students. Siders says Target's after-hours parties could pay off over the long term.
When their parents come to town, they take their parents to the store because they know where it is. And it's now their store. So when you think about all these factors, it can really add up for the store.
Target takes an even longer view. Spokeswoman Leah Guimond says the retailer sees the parties as a way to cement brand loyalty.
It's a way for us to build relationships with these students over the years as they evolve into their different life stages of getting married and having babies and growing with us over the years.
Guimond won't say how much Target makes off these back-to-school parties. The chain store has thrown similar events in other cities in years past. But this year, it expanded the program to Los Angeles, Chicago, and Boston, the city with the most college students per capita. In Boston, I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov for Marketplace.
The Dow Industrials made another run at that theoretically magical 10,000 mark today. The blue chips topped 9,900 at one point before running out of gas. So how long can the rally last? I don't really know, but commentator Robert Reich says that's not really the question we ought to be asking anyway.
So how can the Dow be flirting with 10,000 when consumers, who make up 70% of the economy, have had to cut way back on buying because they have no money? Jobs continue to disappear, houses can no longer function as piggy banks because they're worth far less, and Americans are compelled to pay off their debts and start to save for the first time in a decade. Even more curious, how can the Dow be so far up when every business and Wall Street executive I come across tells me government is crushing the economy with its huge deficits and its supposed takeover of healthcare and autos, housing, energy, and finance? Their anguished cries of socialism are almost drowning out all their cheers over the surging Dow. The explanation is simple. The great consumer retreat from the market is being offset by government's advance into the market. Consumer debt is way down from its peak in 2006. Government debt is way up. Consumer spending is down. Government spending is up. Why have housing prices stopped falling and new housing starts begun? Because the Fed is keeping mortgage rates low by buying up Fannie and Freddie's paper. Why is the healthcare sector booming? Because the government is about to expand coverage to tens of millions more Americans. Why is the financial sector surging? Because the Fed is keeping interest rates near zero, and the rest of the government is still guaranteeing any bank too big to fail will be bailed out. Why are federal contractors doing so well? Because the stimulus has kicked in. In other words, the Dow is up despite the biggest consumer retreat from the market since the Great Depression because of the very things so many executives are complaining about, which is government's expansion. And regardless of what you call it, Keynesianism, socialism, pragmatism, it's doing wonders for business, especially big business and Wall Street. The problem is it's not doing all that much for average working Americans who continue to lose their jobs, whose belts continue to tighten, and who get almost nothing out of the rising Dow.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Coming up, first thing we do, let's not hire any lawyers.
They're freaked out. The whole situation is something that they can't get their hands around and don't understand completely. They're very frightened.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dropped 81 points today, 0.8%, ended things at 9,748. The NASDAQ lost 14 points, about 0.2%, closed at 2,131. The S&P 500 shed 10 points, just over 1%, finished at 1,060. American Airlines lost altitude as it moves forward on plans to take out loans and sell stock to raise $500 million. Shares dropped almost 8% today. Investors downgraded Moody's today. The Wall Street Journal says a former analyst told congressional investigators the credit rating agency wrongly inflated ratings on some bonds earlier this year. Moody's shares lost more than 8%. There's going to be a hearing on that topic, by the way, Thursday on Capitol Hill. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.41%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Why is a cram down like a slice of cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for the month of August. The House Select Energy Independence and Global Warming Committee examines current issues in solar energy development. And commas and colons and quotation marks, oh my, it's National Punctuation Day, exclamation point. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
It is time to dig into that bag of letters, hear what you have to say about what we said. Last week, we told you about car makers working on models that are going to run on clean diesel fuel. We said diesel costs more than gasoline does. What we should have said was, depending on where you live. Ian Miller's in San Diego, California, where regular unleaded is pretty expensive.
Diesel fuel is significantly cheaper than gasoline, and in general, diesel and gas prices go back and forth. I think it hurts diesel all the more when people hear that diesel is flat out more expensive than gas. Diesel is one of the many tools that can help us stretch our petroleum buck as we work to develop a perfect battery fuel cell vehicle.
A lot of you enjoyed Beth Tytel's story on hating voicemail, and you wrote to tell us what you do to avoid listening to those messages. Joe Condo of McLean, Virginia, said this after the beep.
I have been waiting years for this story. I'm a divorce lawyer, and my voicemail greeting used to say right up front, if you leave anything more than your name and number, I probably won't listen. A couple of clients told me that I sounded gruff, so now it just says, leave a very brief message.
Speaking of messages, commentator Farhad Manjoo had one for President Obama last week. In a commentary on the health care debate, he told the president to stop fighting the rumors that repeating lies actually just adds to the number of people who believe them. Mike Mixon of Seattle, Washington, sees it a little bit differently.
I go the other way and say where people are misinformed, it hurts democracy. I understand the commentator's points about how people deal badly with wrong information, and habitually correcting factual errors may be a headache today, but it should pay long-term dividends.
Finally, a correction to my interview last week about the National Football League's blackout policy. We had said the Arizona Cardinals home opener wasn't sold out and so did not air in the greater Phoenix area. Those of you in Phoenix who watched the game on TV wrote to tell us otherwise. We double-checked. Seems that even though the game did not sell out, the league lifted the blackout the night before the game anyway. Keep those cards and letters and corrections coming. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Just as students across the country are settling into their classes, right around now, new lawyers at big firms are settling into their first jobs. Most of those first-year associates have known for at least a year, and some of them maybe two, where they'd be working. Big firms start recruiting way before graduation so they can lock in the best talent. Or that's the way it used to work until the recession hit. With business drying up, some firms have found they can't afford to hire everybody they had promised jobs to. And so the legal profession is rethinking its old-fashioned way of doing things. Ashley Miltite reports.
Bill Urquhart is a partner at law firm Quinn Emanuel Urquhart Oliver & Hedges in Los Angeles. He went to Harvard Law School in August to recruit students for his firm's 2010 Summer Associate Program. But Urquhart says he didn't have the usual competition from rival firms. Those that did show up interviewed fewer candidates. He says for the first time in years, law students, even from the country's top schools, can't guarantee their futures.
They're freaked out. The whole situation is something that they can't get their hands around and don't understand completely. They're very frightened.
They've seen what happened to the class of 2009. Many of those students had jobs set up, only to be told their firms couldn't afford to take them on this fall. Many firms have deferred start dates to next year or beyond. Others have put new associates on half pay and asked them to do pro bono work.
Good afternoon, Ari Carrington and Sutcliffe.
Auric is a global law firm that works with financial institutions and other big companies. CEO Ralph Baxter says when the economy fell apart, Auric's business dropped quite a bit. So the firm didn't hire any new lawyers this year, and it probably won't hire any in the US next year. He says the bad economy is forcing law firms to rethink the way they do things, including the practice of committing to young associates almost 2 years ahead of their start dates and locking in raises.
Law firms are so wedded
to tradition. I mean, we're trained in tradition. We're trained to follow precedent. We've done it this way all these years. We are comfortable with it. Oh, my goodness, we can't change. And it's nonsense. Of course we can change.
One big change ORIC has made is ending the hallowed practice of lockstep. That's when firms promote associates at the same pace, giving lawyers matching raises each year, regardless of whether they do a good or bad job. Baxter says ORIC's lawyers are now promoted the same way other workers are.
They will not earn more money unless they deserve it. And that means we won't be passing additional cost along to the client unless the lawyer is, in fact, able to deliver better, greater service.
Some firms have gone even further. Richard Ripley is a partner at Howery, a law firm in Washington, D.C. His firm has cut the number of hours first-year lawyers need to bill. It's also bolstered training and ended lockstep. Ripley says clients are demanding efficiency now more than ever.
What this economy has done, what I've seen, is that our clients are carefully looking at how many lawyers are on a case, you know, who's doing what type of work, and can the work be pushed down to someone that is more junior?
And thus cheaper. Joel Henning is a consultant to the legal profession. He says it's high time law firms behave more like other businesses, but he's afraid they may return to their spendthrift ways once the economy rebounds.
I think that once we get business more robust and clients are screaming for legal services, that law firms will be screaming for the bodies they need in order to provide the services, and all bets will be off.
Except perhaps those made by clients. Now they've gotten used to getting more for their money, they may not be willing to settle for anything else. I'm Ashley Milne-Tight for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note now before we go, more on a story we brought you earlier this week about the money banks have been making through overdraft fees and debit card charges. Today, two of the country's biggest retail banks, that would be Bank of America and JP Morgan Chase, said they are going to put new limits on those fees. That is a move that will go over well with consumers, no doubt. Probably not so well with the bank's accountants, though. Industry-wide, those fees are expected to bring in almost $39 billion this year. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 81 points, 0.8%. The Nasdaq lost 14 points, about 2/3%. The S&P 500 dropped 10 points, just over 1%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, homeowners face a new kind of scam.
In terms of overt violation of the criminal and civil law, these so-called loan modification companies, they take the prize.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.